Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Spring is here, though it might not feel that way where you are. But as we wait for nature to start over, we wanted to bring you stories of migrants looking for their own new beginnings. To do that, we're heading south, but not southwest. In fact, we're going to Puerto Rico, which is home to about 50 to 150,000 undocumented immigrants, almost entirely from the Dominican Republic. To get to Puerto Rico, those immigrants have to cross a border so dangerous that it can deliver a quick end just as easily as a fresh start. Our producer Marlon Bishop picks up the story.
The other border has no fence to divide it. There are no bridges to cross or checkpoints to be checked at. There's no desert to lose oneself in. The other border is a 60-mile stretch of ocean between the island of Hispaniola, shared by the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and the U.S. Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. It's called the Mona Passage, and those who know it fear it.
It can be nearly flat calm 1 minute, and then of 8 to 10 foot seas the next minute.
Coast Guard Captain Drew Pearson knows the Mona Passage as well as anybody. It's his job to patrol it.
And that can lead to a boat capsizing. That can lead to people being ejected into the water.
The Mona Passage is the main route for illegal immigration to Puerto Rico, mostly from the Dominican Republic. The migrants are brought over by smugglers in small wooden boats called yolas. Each boat can be packed with 100 people or more. It's dangerous, Captain Pearson says, and accidents happen.
The smugglers don't care about them. They don't give a darn about them. All they want to do is get the money and deliver that load and go back and get another one. People need to not do that. They need to stay with their loved ones and figure out a legal way to get to where they want to be.
That may be easy for Captain Pearson to say, but those who choose to migrate see it differently. Puerto Rico is poorer than Mississippi, the poorest state, but it's still almost 5 times wealthier than the Dominican Republic. That means for many Dominicans, the chance to dramatically better their lives is worth the risk of drowning at sea.
Mi nombre es Altagracia Pablo. Soy de origen dominicano.
Meet domestic worker Altagracia Pablo. She lives in Santurce, a lively Dominican neighborhood in San Juan. 10 years ago, she left her mother and 2 young daughters in the DR and decided to trust her fate to the sea. Back home, Altagracia lived in deep poverty. Her house collapsed in a storm, and she and her family were left homeless. Then she made a decision. She borrowed $1,500 to pay the smugglers. They told her to pack a single change of clothes and brought her to Miches, a town on the eastern edge of the island. She vomited over and over again during the 28-hour journey. And that wasn't all. Water leaked into the gas supply, and there were problems with the motor. Under the relentless sun, tensions between passengers sizzled. Fights with knives and bottles broke out. But in the end, they made it to shore, safely and undetected.
Let's go over to the station.
If Altagracia had been caught by the authorities, she might have ended up here, at the Border Patrol station in Aguadilla, a few hours west of San Juan. This is where migrants who are apprehended are taken to get processed. Jeffrey Quinones, a communications officer for U.S. Customs and Border Protection, says Border Patrol recently marked 25 years in Puerto Rico.
I grew up in this side of the island, so I remember before the Border Patrol was here that yolas would just come through.
But over the years, enforcement has gotten stricter.
Well, the best analogy is to come to the door. You have to knock on the door and say who you are and say what's your purpose to coming in. If you come at a place that's not the door, that automatically makes it, you know, crime punishable by immigration law.
While I'm here, a new group of migrants is brought in, just picked up from the sea.
At this point, they just arrived here at the station. We're at the south.
I speak with a Dominican man in handcuffs. I'll call Pedro. Pedro had lived undocumented in Puerto Rico for 11 years, working as a welder. One day, while he was playing dominoes outside with some friends, he was nabbed by immigration agents and sent back to the DR. Since being deported, he's tried to return to Puerto Rico 5 times. Each time, the boat turned back because of bad weather. Finally, this time, he made it across, but his vessel was caught by the Coast Guard. As a repeat migrant, he'll be prosecuted and could serve jail time. Considering everything, Pedro is insanely relaxed about the situation. He says you take a risk knowing you will either win or lose. Either way, amen. They're two sides of the same coin. Actually, most of the migrants at the station aren't Dominican. They're Haitian. And they're not relaxed at all. They look scared and exhausted as they wolf down plates of rice and beans. They're hesitant to talk to me, unsure of who to trust. Their presence reflects the changes in immigration patterns to Puerto Rico. Recently, fewer Dominicans are arriving as the Dominican economy improves. At the same time, there's been an explosion in Haitian migrants. In 2006, only two Haitians were apprehended by Border Patrol. Last year, the number was 600. I asked one of the migrants, a woman who could speak some Spanish, why she came.
Estamos sufriendo y pasamos mucha hambre con mis hijos.
We were suffering, she says. We were going hungry, my kids and I. Was it worse after the earthquake, I ask? Worse, she says.
Peor.
The reason so many Haitians are crossing the Mona is something called the wet foot, dry foot policy. Because of the earthquake, Haitians are currently eligible for TPS, temporary protected status, from the U.S. government. That means that the moment they touch American soil, including the tiny outlying islands that are part of Puerto Rico, they have the right to remain and work in the United States. But if they're caught at sea, even within American waters, they're turned back to Haiti. Although TPS was granted to Haitians to bring relief, it has also created a cruel reality. You're allowed to live in the United States if you can make it here alive. The Haitians who do make it find help from Father Olin Pierre, a Haitian priest in San Juan.
Es el papel primero de un sacerdote ayudar.
Father Olin says that helping the weak is the main duty of a priest, not to mention, they're his people. Puerto Rico has no system in place for dealing with Haitian arrivals, so Father Olin has taken up the slack and turned his church into a makeshift refugee camp. Now, whenever a new Haitian boat comes in, authorities take the migrants straight here. Cots are laid out along the floor of the rectory. Women cook a meal of seafood as the guys watch a DVD on a portable player. One of them is 27-year-old William Joseph.
The trip was not easy.
The waters were rough as they were approaching land, and the Dominican smuggler forced his passengers out of the boat so he could head back quickly. They would have to swim the rest of the way.
So some of us doesn't know how to swim, and I tried to save some of them too. In the end, we have five people missing.
Five of Joseph's companions drowned.
Pero ellos ya habían llegado. Estaba en la orilla.
They had already arrived, says Father Olin, shaking his head. They had a bright future. He trails off. Nobody knows how many migrant bodies lie at the bottom of the Mona Passage. Estimates vary, from single digits to the thousands.
Es como jugando lotería.
It's like playing the lottery, says Father Olin. For the winners who make it to Puerto Rico and onto his church, life in the continental U.S. is so close they can touch it. Father Olin raises money from his congregation to buy them tickets to Miami or New York, where family members await. Almost no one stays in Puerto Rico. Meanwhile, the Dominican migrants, who lack the Haitians' protected status, can't just zip off to the States. Many try. Flights to the mainland are considered domestic, so Dominican migrants just need a fake ID to get on a plane. But it's risky. The majority choose to remain in Puerto Rico. Journalist Carmelo Ruiz says the island completely relies on the Dominican community to function.
I mean, it's the same dynamic with immigrants in the United States. They do a lot of the worst work. And if they left all of a sudden, who's going to fix my car? Who's going to mow the lawn? Who's going to work in agriculture? Who's going to do construction? Who's going to do this? I don't know what would happen. It probably wouldn't be good.
But immigration in Puerto Rico doesn't seem to stir up as much controversy as on the mainland. Here's Jeffrey Quinones from U.S. Customs and Border Protection about how average Puerto Ricans feel about undocumented Dominicans living there.
In Puerto Rico, illegal immigration, it's not necessarily an issue of public concern. Mm-hmm. There's no sense that there's a conflict mm-hmm. about their presence in the country.
He thinks it's because Puerto Ricans and Dominicans share a similar culture, food, music, language. Kelvis Polo, the owner of a discount clothing shop in San Juan, agrees. The presence of the Dominicans just isn't a big deal.
En todos los pueblos, en todas las razas étnicas, siempre va a haber personas que son racistas, otras no. Pero realmente no se ve eso.
Everywhere you'll find a few people who are racist, he says. You don't really see much of that here. You see it more in the States. Still, others I spoke to paint a more nuanced picture. Dominicans are the butts of a lot of jokes, and you might hear Puerto Ricans complaining about Dominicans moving into the neighborhood. And with no legal recourse to turn to, labor abuses are common. Domestic worker Altagracia Pablo says employers sometimes try to take advantage of her and try to make her do more work than she's paid for. That kind of unfair treatment can make her pine for home. But overall, she says, life in Puerto Rico has been good to her.
Y en verdad, mi sueño no es irme para Santo Domingo. Mi sueño es jurar por esta bandera de Estados Unidos.
My dream isn't to go back to the Dominican Republic, she says. It's to pledge allegiance to this flag, to the United States.
Y en verdad, Puerto Rico, I love you.
Truthfully, she says, Puerto Rico, I love you. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
To see photos from Marlon's reporting trip to Puerto Rico, visit latinousa.org. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. These are the sounds of Venezuelan protests from a New York Times video. The situation there has gotten worse in the second month of riots against the government of Nicolás Maduro. At least 35 people have been killed since the protests began. A prominent opposition leader has lost her congressional seat and could be prosecuted for inciting protests. And the government has jailed three generals, suspecting a possible coup. But here in the U.S., media coverage has been spare. And there are some who have been calling out that lack of coverage.
Pero cuando uno ve la cobertura en los medios en Estados Unidos, ve la atención que se le prestó y se le presta a lo que ocurre en Ucrania.
CNN Español's anchor Juan Carlos López says Venezuela hasn't gotten the same attention as Ukraine. And Florida Senator Marco Rubio, his interviewee, agrees.
Ayer yo hice ese punto en Twitter. Yo escribí en Twitter que qué interesante que hay medios de prensa en Estados Unidos que están ignorando lo que ocurre en Venezuela.
According to our research, for every story on Venezuela, there were at least four stories about Ukraine. And as the Venezuelan protests have gotten worse, the amount of coverage has stayed roughly the same.
What a lot of bilingual people in this country go through, this kind of bipolar existence, when you turn on Spanish language news and you watch, you know, Univision or hear Spanish language radio, you hear about a completely different world than when you watch English language mainstream coverage.
That's Hispanic media consultant Gabriela Domenzain. She says Latinos in the U.S. must turn to Spanish language media to fill in the coverage gap. We contacted journalists at some of the news organizations we look at to ask them how they go about covering the world. The New York Times told us in a statement that they weigh international stories based on breaking developments, their impact on markets and business, and the level of U.S. diplomatic involvement. But foreign policy experts agree that there is a lack of interest in Latin America in U.S. newsrooms. And according to Domenzain, the lack of newsroom diversity is also to blame.
All the studies have shown that the increased Latinos in newsrooms actually affect editorial and coverage of Latino issues.
But can mainstream media make more room for foreign coverage that Latinos and other groups care about? And what, besides diversity issues, has gotten in the way of making that happen? Big media have taken the double hit of an economic recession and the internet. News organizations have had to downsize, and their foreign bureaus have been the first to go. Pew Research expert Mike Jerkowitz says, in 2011, only 1 in 10 stories in the American news diet were international.
News emanating from overseas that was not primarily about the United States was a pretty small part of the media menu.
It's not clear if general U.S. audiences just don't care about international news. But what is clear is that communities inside the U.S. care about certain regions, and the digital age may be opening new doors just as it closes others.
If you had a newspaper or a television station or even a national network, your first thoughts were always sort of geographic. You had a community, a physical community, your city, your town, your state, your country. That was your core audience. These digital native outlets have never had to think like that. That's never been their mindset. They have truly grown up in the borderless world of online information and journalism.
Sites like BuzzFeed and the Huffington Post are opening new foreign bureaus, and digital outlets like the Global Post and News Deeply rely on networks of multicultural, multilingual journalists based all over the world. The digital online magazine Quartz is another example. They launched in 2012 with a newsroom that speaks at least 19 different languages. Mitra Kalita is Quartz's ideas editor. She was born in Brooklyn to Indian parents, and she knows how limiting traditional newsrooms can be.
I feel like for much of my career, especially covering immigration and globalization, it could feel uphill as far as getting people to take this story seriously.
Kalita believes that as the U.S. becomes a more diverse country, Quartz's idea of global coverage will become the norm.
So that belief that your story can actually have two audiences at once, I think is pretty revolutionary, but also no longer forces this model of writing for one group of people that is our alleged mainstream and ignoring the community that you are surrounded by.
New media outlets still have to show they can go global and make money in the long run, and that their reporting can be as reliable as traditional media. But here's the bright spot. They're already changing the geography of world news coverage. In any war, it's not just those in battle who suffer. The civilians of war-torn areas also pay a price. More than 5 million people have been forced from their homes in Colombia thanks to a 40-year conflict between the government, left-wing rebels, and right-wing paramilitaries. But now, as the violence has decreased, the Colombian government is encouraging displaced people to go back home. Jennifer Dunn has the story of one family of coffee farmers struggling to do just that.
Jairo Martinez leads me up a narrow trail through steep mountains that rise over Colombia's Caribbean coast, the highest coastal mountains in the world. As we push through the foliage, he points out medicinal plants, parakeets, and butterflies. He helps me over each hazard we pass. Fallen trees, washed out gullies, columns of biting fire ants.
El juez lo primero que ordenó era que la vía tenerla en buen estado. Hasta ahora no han cumplido.
The road was in much better shape before. It was just a short trip to town and back. Now, with all this overgrowth and damage, it takes hours. The government said they would help us repair it, but we're still waiting.
Finally, we arrive at the place that Jairo calls home, a makeshift shelter made of tarp, metal sheets, and scrap wood. His sisters Gloria and Isabel and cousin Angel sit waiting for us with a pot of tinto, coarsely ground coffee boiled with sugar. They live here together without electricity, plumbing, or health services.
Wow, gracias.
Why are these people trying to make a life in such harsh conditions, especially when they're all in their 60s? They tell me it's the perfect home, or at least it used to be.
My farm was just up there. We had everything, pigs, chickens, yuca. We were poor, but we had a full and happy life. Everyone in the community worked together, helped each other.
That was before La Violencia, the war between paramilitary, guerrilla, and military forces that has brutalized Colombia for nearly four decades.
The paramilitaries killed my husband and my son, and they burned everything. Now there's nothing left.
For generations, their village, La Secreta, had been a small, tight-knit yuca and coffee farming community. Then, in the 1980s, left-wing guerrilla rebels moved in, taking advantage of the remote location, rich soil, and cool, clean air to grow coca. A few years later, right-wing paramilitaries moved in to push the guerrillas out. Angel says the locals were caught in the middle.
There were nights we couldn't sleep. There was so much gunfire. We were terrified and just tried to stay out of it. One day, guerrillas forced me to wear their uniform and walk down a path as a decoy to see if the paramilitaries would shoot. They sent me to die. Still, we didn't want to leave. I was born on this land. It's all I had.
But one night in 1998, they had no choice but to flee. Paramilitaries assassinated villagers they accused of being guerrilla sympathizers, then told everyone else they had 1 hour to leave or die. Haido and his family fled to the nearby towns of Cienega and Santa Marta. They struggled to survive. Haido picked up odd jobs. His sisters ironed clothes and sold fried corn cakes on the street. They found town life harsh and strange.
Uno no 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 se halla en el pueblo. Yo a veces bajo y duro cuando duro tres días ya yo me siento incómodo. Quisiera estar aquí en lo mío.
We lived our whole lives on this mountain. We didn't feel comfortable in town. Here we know what to eat. We can just dig a yuca from the earth when we want it. There the food wasn't fresh and it was expensive. The nights were noisy and hot. We felt very bad. We wanted to come home.
Entonces son todas esas cosas que a uno son costumbres que a uno no puede coger la costumbre del pueblo. Ha sido una vida entera de que uno se acostumbró al campo.
La violencia has displaced over 5 million people, more than 10% of the population. In recent years, the government has made progress in disbanding the armed groups and decreasing the violence. Now, a new law offers reparations to people like Haido.
La nueva ley de víctimas y de restitución de tierras de 2011.
Colombia's victims law was enacted in 2011, and it gives social, legal, and financial support to people who have lost family members or land at the hands of guerrillas or paramilitaries.
Diferentes organizaciones como las Águilas Negras, etcétera, etcétera.
Carlos Cruz is a psychologist who works with the government, helping victims of violence overcome their trauma.
Colombia es el único país del mundo que tiene esto y que repara a sus víctimas.
This law is unprecedented internationally in its effort to extend reparations to victims of a conflict that's ongoing.
Mejores cosas para reparar o para de cierta forma ayudar a las víctimas.
The government has offered to help abandoned communities with a host of problems, from restoring utilities to rebuilding schools and clinics. It has yet to deliver on most of these promises, and there are no clear accountability measures in place. Nelsie Perez is familiar with these challenges. She helps reissue land titles to farmers like Haido who were forced to flee. She's here in Cienega at a town fair organized to deliver legal information and support to victims.
Sí, las condiciones básicas son nulas. No hay nada, no hay servicio de agua, no hay luz, no hay...
Life is still precarious in that region. These basic problems have to be addressed to enable people to return and to work their land. Our aim under the victims' law is to not only repair damage inflicted by violence, but even improve living conditions beyond what they were before.
But up in La Secreta, conditions are much worse than before. Despite this, Haido, his sisters, and Angel press forward. Isabel shows me a stone basin where she bathes in spring water every day at dawn, watching the light grow over the ocean below. Haido hands me an orange he picked from a tree behind bushes of magenta flowers. He shows me his young coffee seedlings, plantain, yuca, and ginger plants. Angel describes how perfectly serene the nights are. Still, the way forward is uncertain. Haido worries about the violence repeating itself if the government doesn't provide more security. But what pains him the most is that his children aren't with him. They've adapted to town life. They have kids of their own now, and they don't want to come back.
I tell myself maybe it's better they stay in town. We're all still scared, and at least they're safer there.
But this solitude is not the way they lived in the past, and not what they hoped for when they decided to return.
Without the younger generations here, we feel alone. Sometimes we aren't sure what future we are working so hard for.
But they keep going, hoping one day things will be better. For Latino USA, I'm Jennifer Dunn in La Secreta, Colombia.
And now, for some numbers. There are about 25 million Latinas living in the U.S., but only 1% hold political office. There's never been a Latina U.S. senator, and there's only been one Latina governor.
We know that there have been 12,000 members of Congress since this country was founded over 200 years ago. 10 Latinas.
That's Marnie Allen, the director of Political Parity, a national group that supports women in office. This year, they're partnering with an advocacy group called the National Hispanic Leadership Agenda in an effort to get more Latinas elected to office. They're calling their initiative Latinas Represent. Leslie McClurg has more now from their kickoff in Denver.
Lucy Flores never envisioned a career in politics when she was growing up in Las Vegas. In fact, she was barely getting by.
I come from a broken family. My mother left when I was 9 years old.
Without much direction at home, Lucy turned to gangs for support. At age 15, she was on juvenile parole. At 17, she dropped out of school.
People really just start to give up on you. You are no longer an investment opportunity. You're now just considered a waste to the state and to society.
But then her parole officer took a special interest in her, becoming a mentor. The officer encouraged Flores to get her GED and then pushed her to think about college. It worked. Flores graduated from the University of Southern California and then law school. Today, she's an assemblywoman in Nevada, representing the district where she grew up.
It's because I got lucky and I got a really amazing person who took some time and energy for me.
Flores is sharing her story at the first meeting of Latinas Represent. For Marnie Allen of Political Parity, it illustrates why candidates from diverse backgrounds are important.
Latinas are over 8% of the U.S. population now, and there are a lot of voices that have been missing and experiences that can inform different ways of going about policy change.
But she says Latinas face steep cultural and gender barriers that keep them from influencing policy. A recent study highlighted at the kickoff names a few: sexual harassment, poverty-level pay, minimal access to health care. And Latinas earn about 60 cents for each dollar that white men earn. So if you're struggling day to day, how are you supposed to think about running for office? And on top of that, it can be hard to convince Latinas to run because, like many women, they tend to see themselves as supporters rather than leaders. Allen asked the 9 Latinas in Congress how they do it.
And what they said was, for me to get past this point of asking for myself, I had to think of it actually as asking for my community. I'm not asking you to give me money for me. It's for you. It's for us.
So Allen says Latinas Represent is all about encouraging women to do what they do naturally, network.
We're going to open up our iPhones and we're going to blast our email lists and we're going to get behind these Latinas and we're going to recruit.
They're starting in Colorado because there's a higher number of Latinas in office here than anywhere else. And they'll be holding similar conferences in California, Washington, D.C., Texas, and Florida. So what if more Latinas were in office?
I think we would see a very different debate around immigration, around Dreamers, a lot of economic issues and education issues, particularly where you have women-headed households.
And that's not all.
So when you're talking about childcare issues, nutritional issues, our health, you know, right away we come with a lot of credibility to the table.
That's Helen Iris Torres. She's director of Hispanas Organized for Political Equality, or HOPE, based in California. She emphasizes that Latina stereotypes are actually political advantages.
We could be sexy, we can be nurturing, we can be as mad as hell, and we can be strong leaders. We have that all in us.
Meanwhile, Assemblywoman Lucy Flores continues to charge ahead. She just announced that she's running for Nevada's lieutenant governor. But it wasn't an easy decision.
It's not human to not be afraid.
But in politics, Flores says fear is not an option.
And who knows, maybe we will be talking about the first Latina candidate for president.
For Latino USA, I'm Leslie McClurg.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week we're talking new beginnings, which sometimes can be hard. Take teen parents. They have the odds stacked against them. They're more likely to drop out of high school, and their kids are more likely to end up in jail. But one young California couple says their daughter has been their motivation to stay together and defy those odds. reporter Rebecca Plevin introduces us to this couple as they start on the next chapter in their lives.
Stephanie Huerta got pregnant at 13. People said she and her boyfriend, Angel Alvarez, had ruined their lives. Those people should see them now. It's early morning, and Stephanie is making quesadillas for her small family. She's now 21, mature but with an easy laugh. Angel is also 21, with a thin mustache and a natural sweetness about him. Their daughter, Emily, is a spunky 7-year-old.
I think what's made us, you know, stay together was that we both shared a common goal. We had our daughter, but we wanted to, you know, make her proud. And whether we were going to be together or not, you know, we wanted to do everything we could for her.
It's been a long road, one that started more than 150 miles away from the University of California at Santa Cruz. Stephanie and Angel both grew up poor, the children of Mexican immigrants who worked in California's agricultural Central Valley. They first met in elementary school in Raisin City.
And it's funny because when I tell people about Raisin City, they actually think it's a city, you know, and, you know, and to a lot of people, it's really not. Like, the truth is that there are actually more raisins than there are people.
They reconnected in eighth grade. In ninth grade, Stephanie got pregnant.
We were still really young, but luckily Angel was, at the time, you know, he's 14, so, but he was very mature for his age, and, you know, he told me that he was going to be there for me and support me, and, you know, that was really great, but, you know, at 14, how are you supposed to get a job? How are you supposed to, like, maintain anything?
That was just one of the problems they faced.
And people would just make comments and, like, you know, like, they'd just stare at me when I'd walk down the hall. And being pregnant that young, you know, people are so judgmental. And it's not just, like, students. It's also, like, teachers and everybody, you know.
Angel caught flack, too.
My people basically, when they found out that, you know, I was going to be a dad for the first time, you know, I received comments kind of like saying, like, hey, like, you know, you're going to work in the fields, you know, grab a shovel. That was the other popular one. You just messed up your life and, you know, kind of things like that.
But they leaned on each other and their families. Angel places a comforting hand on Stephanie's leg and keeps it there. They also had help from their high school counselor, Rebecca Aguila. She was surprised that a good kid like Stephanie was pregnant, but was impressed with how she handled it.
And they had a plan. I mean, they were going to go for it and not let anything get in their way. And I asked them, well, do you plan on going to college? What do you want to do? And they both said yes. And so I said, okay, then that's what we're going to work on.
They graduated at the top of their high school class and decided to go to UC Santa Cruz together. She majored in human biology, he in psychology. But things were harder there.
I got a 0.0 the first quarter that I was here. I didn't think that was possible.
Angel says the pressure of taking challenging classes and trying to be the strong male head of the household was overwhelming. Stephanie says her struggles came later as her science courses got harder and she had to take night classes and hold down a job.
And it's hard as a mother to live with that guilt, you know, that you're not always there for your kid. You know, you wish you could, but you can't. But, you know, like Angel, which, you know, I really love Angel for, he reminds me, you know, you're doing it for a reason.
Emily.
Then if you defeat him.
They hope she'll walk across the stage with them when they graduate in June. They have even bigger plans for her later on.
But it's stronger, a little stronger than this one and that one.
Angel and Emily are sitting on the ground, play fighting with Lego action figures they'd made. She puts hers down to demonstrate what she'll do as the flower girl in her parents' wedding in September.
I was practicing being the flower girl with the balls because I was like this. And I'm pretending it's like a flower, like a big flower. So I could go, here you go, here you go.
They're not getting married because they have to. They're doing it because they love each other. Angel says he's come a long way from feeling like he's had to prove his critics wrong.
My motivation, it's forgetting all what the past, basically. It's the present, and now it's my daughter and her.
Angel says he wants to earn a master's degree and become a school counselor like the ones who have helped him. Stephanie also wants to earn another degree and work in healthcare, focusing on teen pregnancy. They've been honest with Emily about the struggles they faced as young parents, but also the rewards.
Sometimes she'll be like, "Mommy, was it like hard to have me?" And like, and you know, like, and I'll tell her, "Yes, it was hard, you know, but you were like the reason we went to school. You were the reason why we graduated." And yeah, so.
For Latino USA, I'm Rebecca Plevin in Santa Cruz, California.
At the age of 21, JT Lopez had the kind of success many young people can only dream of. He was a sought-after session musician in his native Puerto Rico, playing gigs and touring with some of the island's top musicians. But then he gave it all up to follow his own beat by starting over in a new town. Diane Bach has our story.
Snow in Africa is on a mission to become one of the top rock and roll acts in the world.
The wonderful thing about them, for me, is that they're fresh and new, and they're not doing the old stuff over and over.
Don Peake would know. He's been part of the rock and roll scene for half a century. He played lead guitar for the Everly Brothers, and he helped create Phil Spector's Wall of Sound. It takes a lot to impress him.
You know, they have original material, they have a good sound, they look great, and they're really nice people.
It's said that music bridges the gaps between cultures, and Snow in Africa is a case in point. Nick Soliday, the band's founder and lead singer, is from Oklahoma. Lead guitarist Kai Nakamura grew up in Japan. Drummer Pavel Waldman is from the Czech Republic. And then there's bass player Juan Tomas Lopez, otherwise known as JT.
I come from a little town. It's called Rincón, Puerto Rico. I remember when I was like really small, my dad would be just pumping music out, and my mom and my dad would go dancing, and it was like salsa music.
JT was 12 when he picked up his first instrument, a guitar that was a hand-me-down from his sister. A few years later, he switched to playing bass. From then on, he ate, slept, and breathed music.
I literally woke up really early in the morning, warmed up, practiced, went to class, went practice, had no social life.
JT studied classical and Latin jazz at the prestigious Conservatory of Music of Puerto Rico. He trained with exceptional musicians like Eddie Gomez, the Grammy Award-winning jazz bassist. They didn't just teach him about music. They taught him about identity.
When you're studying in a conservatory in a place like this, there, you know, you're an artist. You have to remember that you can't forget where you come from, and you have to have this history in you. It's not play music and don't know anything about your culture. So these people, you know, basically ingrained that on me.
Meanwhile, outside of school, JT was becoming a highly sought-after session player.
I played salsa, I played jazz, I played reggae. Everything you could think about, I've done that you could play on that little island.
But he wasn't satisfied.
When you're, you know, a session player, you think like, I just need money and I'll play and whatever, and I want to create something that lasts forever.
In search of that something, JT responded to a listing he saw for a bass player in LA.
I saw this ad, I read it like 5 times, and I saw myself playing with the guys.
So he picked up his bass and flew from San Juan to Los Angeles.
So JT's audition tape was awesome.
Snow in Africa's Nick Soliday.
When he first got out here and he moved in, he literally came up for the audition and we're like, we don't want you to go, you know, you're moving in. He brought a flag, his flag. We stuck it up on the wall.
Two, one, two. I have to think in Spanish and translate. It's just how I roll. But I know Kai does too. And, you know, you see us like looking at each other and we're like saying stuff in different languages, but we understand each other.
With a glance and a chord change, they communicate. At a club in San Luis Obispo, the band's firing on all cylinders. Jonathan Valls just discovered the band, and he's seeing them for the second time in a week.
If anyone listening gets a chance to see Snow in Africa, come like take that chance, because it's a great, great experience.
It's also a lot of hard work with no guarantee of success.
We can't stop the rain.
Right now, they're 4 guys in their 20s sharing a dream and a 2-bedroom apartment in LA.
The funny thing about the band is that it seems like it's all meant to be. I love these guys. A lot of bands say that, you know, we live together, we're a family band.
And while the band can't replace JT's family back in Puerto Rico, he's landed in another place that feels like home. For Latino USA, I'm Diane Bach in Los Angeles.
Being Latino often means turning on the TV and not seeing ourselves or the world we live in reflected back at us. The amount of digital media gives us better options, but on the big networks, diversity still lacks. The current network season that is wrapping up gave us a few things to be excited about, but it ended up disappointing at least one young woman, our intern, Antonia Cerejido.
I love television, and I'm a Latina, so I was really excited about TV this season. Not one, but two of my guilty pleasures were going to star Latinos. Juan Pablo Galaviz, born in the U.S. but raised in Venezuela, was going to be the new Bachelor, as in, you know, The Bachelor.
And I can't believe I'm the first Latino Bachelor. I like that. The Bachelor.
And Shakira was coming back as a coach on the singing competition The Voice for the second time.
You know, I'm just so glad to be back. We're like a second family here.
It was a big deal. Here you had two of the four national broadcast networks make the decision to incorporate Latinos as stars on their respective flagship shows. But now that Latinos make up 16% of the television viewing public, I'm sure the big networks don't want to lose out. But as I started watching, I found myself cringing far too many times. Over on ABC, Juan Pablo has been deemed the most hated bachelor of all time. First, he said he thought a gay bachelor would set a bad example for kids. Then he upset people again when he tweeted a joke that made fun of people with mental disabilities. On the flip side, Shakira has been getting less than ideal treatment from her fellow coaches on The Voice. The male coaches make fun of her accent.
These are alpha dogs.
What are we?
Alpha dogs.
Alpha dogs.
Alpha dogs.
They also talk about how pretty she is, but they never talk about her ability. Which seems a bit crazy because she has a net worth greater than all the male coaches combined. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't expect much more for my admittedly guilty pleasures. I do love that I get to see more people on TV who have accents like my parents. But I'm hoping that the next time I get excited about Latinos on television, it will be for something with a little more substance. For Latino USA, I'm Antonia Cerejido.
Antonia Cerejido was one of our interns here at Latino USA this semester. We'll miss her as she begins her final classes at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in Chicago. Best of luck, Antonia. Well, while The New Bachelor hasn't proven popular among Americans, here at Latino USA, we just welcomed our newest producer, Camilo Vargas. Camilo Vargas was born and raised in Colombia. For this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, Camilo tells us about being a foreign reporter in the U.S. and about his quest to discover what being Latino actually means.
On one of my first reporting assignments for Latino USA, I went to a Red Cross shelter set up to house people displaced by the explosions in East Harlem. When I got there, I saw a group of English-speaking reporters interviewing people outside the building. The officers let me in without a lot of questions because I looked Latino and spoke Spanish. But for me, being Latino is a new thing. I've always identified as Colombian, so some of the things that Americans take for granted are not obvious to me because I didn't grow up here. Like, thinking of myself in terms of race. When filling out forms, I can check Hispanic as my ethnicity, but then I have no idea what to check between Native American, white, and black, because I know I'm probably a centuries-old mix of the three. As a foreign reporter, I'm actually learning what it means to be Latino in the United States. And it's confusing because everyone from rich Latin Americans in Miami to undocumented warehouse workers in New Jersey, we all get lumped up into the one Latino-Hispanic category. So I try to go beyond how the mainstream thinks of Latinos by asking a lot of questions like any trained reporter should. I've talked to second-generation Americans who grapple with speaking Spanish. They were told to speak proper English at school while also being pressured to speak proper Spanish by fellow Latinos. Because if you're Latino, you have to speak proper Spanish, right? I've seen children who have grown up here and identify as American, but don't have the papers to prove it. And I've seen people who have an American passport, but were only born here. But that doesn't matter, because so-called Latinos seem to have to prove how American they are a bit harder than most. And here's another thing. Latinos here are assumed to be a bit lazier, more laid back, and more fun-loving. But the Latino PhD students I've met and the immigrants that wake up before sunrise to be at work have a thing or two to say about that. I, too, struggle with ideas about my country, like the very 1990s notion that Colombia is a country overrun by drug dealers. And people are surprised to hear that I'm actually married to my husband in Colombia, where gays have more civil rights than in more than a few U.S. states. So when I'm out reporting, I'm careful not to assume anything about Latinos or any other communities that I cover. I want to find out what they struggle with and what they choose to celebrate. I want to know what being Latino means to you and to your community. I don't let anyone define how Latino I'm supposed to be. It's something I'm still figuring out on my own. For Latino USA, I'm Camilo Vargas.